Welcome to the Human Capital Lab podcast, where learning transforms work and lives. Hosted by Executive Director Rich Douglas, we explore how education and innovation create opportunities to drive impact in the field of talent development. Get ready. Today's episode starts now.
Hey, everybody. Rich Douglas, the Executive Director of the Human Capital Lab at Bellevue University, here with another Human Capital Lab podcast. Today we have as our guest, Jeffrey Neal. Jeff is a long-time executive in human capital management. Jeff and I know each other from his role as the Chief Human Capital Officer of the Department of Homeland Security, but that's certainly not the only place that he's been. He's had a long and extensive experience in leading human capital programs and departments throughout both the government and in the private sector. Since leaving the government, Jeff spent time with as a senior vice president of ICF consulting firm, and then now is the principal of ChiefHRO.com. That's ChiefHRO.com, where he is doing independent consulting. I really recommend that you go out to the website and log on there and see Jeff's blogs and see the kinds of things that he's doing and become a member and have that feed fly to your mailbox. I think there's a lot to learn there. And I just can't believe I've got you on the podcast today, Jeff. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Good to see you again.
Is there anything about your background that I left out that you'd like to make sure that people know?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, I guess I had a somewhat unusual career in some respects. Most of my career was in HR in the federal government, most of that in the Department of Defense, about 13 years with the Department of the Navy and 13 years with the Defense Logistics Agency. And my last role in DOD was as the head of HR, the J-1 for the Defense Logistics Agency. I did that for 9 years. And then where my career got a little unusual is you've always heard of people, of political appointees burrowing into career jobs. I was a career executive and I burrowed out into a political position. And so I went from a career job at DLA to a political appointment as the Chief Human Capital Officer for DHS. And I actually convinced Janet Napolitano when I left to make that position a career job. And now the Trump administration, of course, is wanting to make CHECOs more political and make them all SES general and try to fill a lot of them with political folks. I can't say that's a horrible move. I mean, it would be a little hypocritical of me to, as a former political CHECO, to say, oh God, you shouldn't be what I was. That'd be terrible. So I can't really criticize that move too much. But I just thought it was better for DHS to have some continuity in that role. Because, you know, at 2.5 years, I was the longest serving CHECO at the time. And having career folks in there, I think Angie Bailey served in the job for probably 5 years or more. So, you know, having a career person was probably a better idea, but I enjoyed both roles, both as a career executive and as a political appointee. Just a very different way of looking at things, though. The political role was more interesting in a lot of respects than the career role.
And what are some of the things that you're doing now as at the Chief HRO?
You know, mostly I am just writing about things that I have an opinion about. I do a little consulting, but for the most part, I'm not that interested in doing that much of that anymore. I'm at a point in my life where I don't really need to work, and I only do things that I enjoy doing. So I'll talk to people like you who I think I would enjoy talking with and who could have an interesting conversation. I write about things that I care about. I do interviews with people to talk about things I care about. And right now, what I care about is the federal workforce and some of what's happening to the federal workforce, which I think is, you know, there's some incredibly disruptive stuff going on right now. And it's very troubling to see that, knowing, I mean, you and I both, as former federal employees, know that the federal workforce is far more capable and dedicated than a lot of people give them credit for. There are a lot of incredibly talented people in government who are not there to get rich, because we both know you don't get rich being a federal employee. They're there to be public servants and to serve the American people. And I wish more people would give them credit for that. I don't think there's enough credit being given to the federal workforce for what they do. And the fact that they're showing up right now in the face of really you know, pretty unprecedented attacks on them. You know, before he was reappointed to OMB, the director of OMB said he wanted the bureaucrats to suffer. He wanted them to be frightened when they came to work. That's pretty sad, you know, that we've got senior people in the White House who would have that kind of opinion and, you know, not only have it, but, you know, but say it out loud. You know, it's one thing when people, you know, have pretty radical opinions and they keep them to themselves, but when they're saying them out loud, you know, it's like, okay, you know, this is what we want the policy to be. That's really troubling to me.
You know, most people who are viewing this, they, regardless of where they stand on this, they know the stereotypes and they know the kinds of things that are tossed about, but it's almost like noise that federal employees have just kind of accepted. All right, fine. There's going to be people that are going to make that kind of noise and it doesn't really matter that much. This isn't noise. This is actions that are disrupting tens of thousands of people's lives. Can you share with us more about what you think that was behind it? And what do you think the end game is in all this?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think this is one of those cases where people should give President Trump credit for doing what he said. He made it pretty clear during the campaign that he wanted to get revenge against some people. And so he wasn't hiding it, saying it out loud repeatedly. And so, you know, his approach, a lot of people thought the approach would be, you know, something along the lines of Project 2025, which probably was accurate since, you know, the architect of Project 2025 is running OMB now and implementing Project 2025. But he kind of rolled a grenade across the table by appointing Elon Musk to run the Department of Government Efficiency, or as I call it, the destruction of government everywhere.
Okay, wait a minute. We can stop and write that down, everybody. The destruction of government everywhere, otherwise known as Doge. Okay.
Yeah, and so Musk came in and basically did what he did when he acquired Twitter, which is just, you know, take a chainsaw to the place and start cutting things right and left without necessarily, and you know, and they kept saying, you know, well, it's the Silicon Valley approach of move fast and break things. Not really. You know, people in Silicon Valley, when they are moving fast and breaking things, generally do it with a clear purpose in mind and some, you know, intent to make money out of what they're doing. And they tend to do things that are better thought out. What we've seen with Doge has not really been well thought out. You know, that's pretty well evidenced by, you know, getting rid of people who manage nuclear weapons programs in the Department of Energy and then saying, oh, crap, we didn't realize they did that.
Yeah.
And then trying to hire the people back, you know, offering early retirements and buyouts to air traffic controllers when the previous administration had spent 4 years trying to get to the point where they had net growth in the number of air traffic controllers. You know, cutting programs to, you know, to deal with health problems with first responders from the World Trade Center attacks. You know, getting rid of a lot of the people who were doing that, getting rid of people who are providing vital services to veterans. You know, we promised veterans that if they serve, we'll take care of them and take care of their health after they are out of the military. But, you know, they're wanting to cut tens of thousands of people out of the Department of Veterans Affairs without any real plan behind how they're going to provide the services when those people are gone. You know, we have seen reductions in the Internal Revenue Service that most experts would tell you are going to end up with a net reduction in tax revenues because people will know it's easier to cheat because there are fewer people to audit those returns at the IRS. So, you know, I think what we're seeing, and we've also seen that, I'm sure it's coincidental that some of the agencies that had gone after Elon Musk's various business for shady business practices happen to be ones that Doge is targeting. I'm sure that's just a coincidence.
Oh, absolutely. Let me adjust that for sarcasm.
So I think there's, you know, that what we're seeing is what President Trump promised during the campaign, which is he wanted revenge, and we're seeing that happening. The downside of that's you know, I think is becoming apparent to a lot of people, is that a lot of these programs are things that people care about. And there are going to be consequences to some of these cuts. We don't even know what the consequences are all going to be. You know, former administrator of Commissioner of Social Security said he thought that there was a chance the Social Security system could just fail sometime this year because they've cut so many people there. And they, you know, they propose things like, you know, making people do everything online, closing Social Security offices. I don't know if you've dealt with a lot of people who are older when it comes to and dealing with technology, but, you know, while there are people my age and older who are very adept with technology, and that would be no problem to do things online, there are also people like my mother-in-law who, God help us, if she had to use a computer for something.
Right.
So going to some of the least technologically literate people in the country and saying, we want you to use technology to interact with the system that provides a significant portion of your income is probably not the best idea. And closing Social Security offices probably wasn't the best idea. So, you know, we could see, you know, significant failure in a program like Social Security. We could see problems with air traffic control at, you know, perhaps airports like Newark, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. We could see all kinds of problems developing and then not necessarily have a good way to fix them. And I think that's the kind of thing that worries people who are very familiar with government, that they realize that breaking government is easy. That's a really simple thing. If you want to break, you and I could walk in and break government really quickly. It's not that hard to do. Putting it back together again is, you know, the Humpty Dumpty of government isn't necessarily going to get put back together very quickly.
Yeah.
And that's what concerns me, is we are driving out talent. The type of, you know, the approach they used wasn't driven by, you know, a really in-depth analysis of what an agency was doing, what its mission ought to be, what's the most effective way to deliver that mission. You know, that kind of analysis that most of us would have expected before proposing really radical cuts never happened. You know, it was a bunch of relatively young, very inexperienced, not knowledgeable about government people who went in and just started cutting stuff.
Well, they kind of went after low-hanging fruit, too. They went after the most vulnerable, the people that were on probation status, the people who might not fight back, might not even...
And what you end up with that is you get people who are... when you tell people, we'd like for you to leave, you know, we'll make it easy for you to leave. We'll keep you on admin leave for months and let you go out and look for another job. We'll make it easy for you to leave. Who leaves? The most marketable people. The best talent are the people who leave. You know, if you look at the people in government, and you and I both know there are people in government who have been coasting for a long time.
Sure. Like any organization, like any bureau.
Yes. Do you think when you start encouraging people to go away that those are the people who are going to go? You know, those are the people who sit on their ass all the time. They're going to continue to sit there. They are not going to pack up and go. The people who are going to pack up and go are the ones who are very talented, who are very motivated, who decide that they own their own career and they're going to make the decisions that are best for them, and they get out. So what you do is you end up losing some of your very best talent. You know, then they decide they'll get rid of all the probationary employees, many of whom are the younger employees. You know, the federal government has more employees over age 60 than it does under age 30.
Really?
And so do you really want to get rid of the younger folks in the government? You know, we've seen what happens when you do that. During the Clinton administration, some of us are old enough to remember the Clinton administration, and they had something called reinventing government. And that was something that Vice President Al Gore led. There was a lot of really interesting stuff done as a part of reinventing government, some of it good, some of it not so good. One of the things they did is they cut two occupations in particular, really radically, and that was procurement and HR. They said these were central control organizations, and they were basically getting in the way of people getting things done. So let's get rid of a lot of HR people and procurement people. What that caused was basically a total stop in hiring HR and procurement people for several years. Then you end up a few years later with this whole generation of people who should be in the workforce who were never hired. And we, you know, when I was at DHS, when you and I were both at DHS, we were still trying to recover from HR being broken during the Clinton administration. So I guess the good thing is it's both parties can screw things up. You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat to be the one to screw things up. You know, both of them can do it. But what we found with stopping that hiring during the Clinton administration is that it took years to recover. And I would argue in some respects that federal HR never recovered, that it's that they basically broke it. And, you know, here, a couple decades later, it's still broken. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's kind of troubling.
Well, in the Clinton effort led by Gore, there was an outcome that they sought. Whether they did it well or not, mm-hmm. they were trying to be efficient. They were trying to modernize the government. They were trying to say, look, there are better ways to do this. We're a new generation. We're gonna look at it differently. That doesn't seem to be the motivation this time around. It doesn't seem to be about efficiency, despite the E in DOGE. It doesn't seem to be about the outcome being better. What do you think they're up to? What is the Trump administration trying to accomplish if it's not cake?
Part of it, I think, is the same approach that they've taken with tariffs. You know, the president believes pretty clearly that you can exert your will and intimidate people into giving you what you want. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that happens with tariffs is still yet to be seen. I would argue it probably isn't going to work out quite that way, since right. the agreement they've announced with China basically gave China everything they wanted. But I think they're trying to do the same thing with the federal workforce. And that's create so much fear that the federal workforce will be much more compliant in doing things the administration wants to do. They made it pretty clear that during the first term, the president believed that people, you know, in the deep state, you know, make federal employees sound sinister, call them the deep state, that the deep state was really out there just trying to stop anything from ever happening in the first Trump administration. So they want to make certain that doesn't happen this time. And the way to do it is to go through, cut right and left, make people fear for their jobs so that they won't talk back when you tell them to do something that's maybe not legal or not proper. And that's kind of a sad thing, because the reality is that, you know, I've worked with Democratic and Republican administrations over the years, and one of the things that you'll hear both Republican and Democrat appointees saying is, I wish I had trusted the federal workforce earlier. You know, I was an Obama appointee, and the Obama administration actually put together training, which I conducted, to train their appointees on how to work with the career workforce, because they recognize that this is a problem that every administration has. They come in and they don't trust the career people. They assume that right. they assume they were all appointed by people in the other party, and they can't trust them. And then they find out that, you know, federal employees
just doing their job.
They know that their job is to carry out the policies of the president. And you find Republicans in the federal workforce who carry out Democrat policies, and you find Democrats who carry out Republican policies, because they know that that's what their job is. Their job is to carry out the policies of the elected official. And so that's what they do. They may not like it. You know, they may hate it, but they do it. And yeah, there are going to be times when they try to slow roll something because they think it's, you know, they're about to drive off a cliff. I worked for somebody a long time ago, though, who said, you know, your job is to tell me I'm about to drive off a cliff. My job is to decide whether I want to hit the gas or hit the brake.
Yeah.
And most federal employees get that. They get that, you know, they don't have to like the policies that the administration is trying to put into place. They just have to carry them out, unless they're illegal. And even if they're illegal, there are times when they're required to carry them out. They should, you know, record their protest that they don't like the something that they think is illegal. But, you know, their job is to carry out the policies of the administration. What they're going to find, I'm afraid, is that they, you know, the political appointees don't do anything on their own. They cannot execute any policy. How can a few hundred employees in an agency the size of DHS, for example, how can a couple hundred appointees or less, you know, carry out everything that department needs to do? They can't. They have to rely on the career workforce. If you break the career workforce, whether you trust them or not, you also break your capability sometimes to execute on your priorities. So what they might find is in the end, you know, they scare the federal workforce, they get rid of 10% of them, they might save a little bit of money, but probably not. And they're left with a workforce that can't execute on the things that they want to do. And that's not the best way to, you know, to get an efficient government. It's probably the way to get a very inefficient government. And then they'll get mad at the workforce because they can't execute even after they whack the living daylights out of them. So it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. What impresses me is how many federal employees are still going to work, still doing their jobs every day. They are not being intimidated into quitting and just running away. They're doing their jobs. And a lot of them are going to continue to do that, and they will continue to do that for a long time. And so I'm very impressed with the resilience of the federal workforce in the face of a pretty significant onslaught from DOGE.
You know, you talk about the impact of the civilian workforce, and I couldn't help but reflecting on my military career. And I enlisted out of high school when Carter was president. And then I was commissioned as an officer when Reagan was president. And then we had this huge surge, you know, of this huge buildup. And then my career and everybody else's career disappeared under Clinton with the peace dividend and the shrinkage. And Jeff, I got to tell you, now that I'm reflecting on this, looking back, and I'm thinking, I think the only time I ever heard anybody ever complain about a politician during that entire period of time was with Carter, because we were getting pay raises because inflation was crazy. That's it. In other words, it just doesn't seep down to the day-to-day activities. Oh, sure. You know, when I was in immigration, when we changed from Obama to Trump, there were changes and we felt it. And absolutely, we had to make adjustments. And there were people who had strong feelings about the way that the agency should operate and what it should be emphasizing that would change from president to president. But doing their jobs on an everyday basis, you didn't sit around talking about politics. No. You sat around talking about a backlog you had to clear out, or you know, something you had to get done before the end of the day. That's really what you were focused on. And I think it's a, you know, it's a real unfortunate thing that people embrace this mythology of the deep state as if this cabal of workers is sitting around trying to run up against one politician and try to run with the next one. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, they tend to, you know, people have this idea that you know, federal employees are all, you know, isolated from the American people. They're all sitting in their ivory towers in Washington, and you know, they're all talking about politics day and night, and they're actively trying to undermine the president. Roughly 15% of the federal workforce is in Washington. So 85% of the federal workforce are in Texas and Tennessee and California and New York and Virginia, away from D.C. So there are far more federal employees out in the hinterlands than there are in the ivory tower. And the concern about politics is, you know, probably more pronounced in the D.C. area just because of the proximity to the White House and the Capitol. And It's probably a little bit more pronounced there, but out in, I worked for a long time in Jacksonville, Florida. We didn't sit there and talk about politics. We sat there and talked about how we could get the work done. And I worked in Memphis, Tennessee. We didn't sit there and talk about politics. We talked about getting the work done. And that's what most people are doing when they go to work in, you know, in Dubuque, Iowa, or Los Angeles, California, or Atlanta, Georgia, or Dallas, Texas, or Norfolk, Virginia. They're really more worried about their mission and getting the work done. You know, I worked at DLA headquarters during on September 11th, 2001. I was running HR for DLA at the time. And after those attacks on September 11th, we were told the next day, don't come to work. You know, stay away. They were concerned about security. They just said, stay away, take the day off the next day on September 12th. I got up, I went to work. There was a line a mile long of cars waiting to get in the base. All these people showing up to work. They were told they could have a free day off.
Yeah.
And their response was, bullshit. I am not going to be scared away from doing the mission. So they showed up for work. And most of the employees who were told that you have a free day off showed up for work. And they continued to do their jobs. And I've seen that over and over again, particularly in the Department of Defense. And I will admit I have a bias toward the workforce in the Department of Defense because I've worked in that department for 26 years. But those folks care about the mission. And the mission is supporting our troops. In DLA, it was providing food and fuel and medicine and clothing and things like that for the troops, spare parts for the troops. And that was the concern. They really didn't care that George Bush was president or George H.W. Bush was president or Barack Obama or Joe Biden or Donald Trump. They might have cared in their personal life about that, but for work, they cared about the mission. And how do we get the work done and make certain that the troops that we are supporting get what they need? So that's what they did. And that's that kind of workforce should be appreciated and celebrated and not attacked and tried to, you know, you shouldn't be trying to make them frightened when they come to work because they're carrying out a mission that is incredibly important. You know, our military cannot function without the 700,000 civilian employees of the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. The Department of Veterans Affairs certainly can't function without those 300,000+ people who work in the Veterans Benefits Administration or the Veterans Health Administration or even in the Cemetery Administration, which is, you know, is responsible for the final resting place of American soldiers and sailors, airmen and Marines. So these agencies can't function without a dedicated workforce. And luckily, they have it. And I would like to see that workforce celebrated and bolstered and supported, not criticized and, you know, condemned, attacked, particularly with attacks that are not true at all. They're simply not true. This idea that these are all, you know, rabid partisans is just ridiculous. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. So
and they didn't feel like heroes that day. They felt they were probably mad. They were probably energized. They were probably very emotional, no doubt about that. But they put their hard hat on and they went into the mine and they got stuff done. Yeah. And that's what drove everybody was, you know, and I lived in the D.C. area. I wasn't with the government at the time, but I was in the D.C. area in Northern Virginia when the attacks occurred. And that's the attitude, the prevailing attitude around was, all right, let's dust ourselves off. We're going to rebuild here and we're going to deal with that there.
Yeah.
They put their big boy pants on and they went to work, you know? And I think that you're right. That is admirable.
And coming one of the things that people don't know probably, because it really was not something that was newsworthy. You know, when the airplane flew into the Pentagon, it flew in to the Army G1 space, which is HR. I think the most senior person killed in the Pentagon was the Army G1, the 3-star who ran HR for the Department of the Army.
Yeah.
A lot of the people who died that day were Army HR people who were sitting in the Pentagon supporting soldiers. That was their job. I mean, they were making certain that the civilian workforce was there. They were making certain that the military personnel programs were operating. So a bunch of HR people sitting there minding their own business had an airplane fly into their office and kill a lot of them. Yeah. So I don't look at the people who are doing that kind of work and think, oh my God, these are some sort of political hacks who are out to undermine the president. I look at them as people who go in every day and do their work and do a good job for the most part and care about the mission. And I've never seen a more mission-focused bunch of people than I did in the Department of Defense for those 26 years I was there. So it bugs me when I hear people criticizing them like they're some sort of, you know, useless political hacks who are just there trying to undermine the president, because they weren't. You know, I put something in my last blog post for Public Service Recognition Week about a speech that President George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, gave 6 days after he took office. He met with a large group of senior executives, and he told them that he wanted their help, that he wanted, you know, that he had a conservative approach to government, but he also recognized that you don't have to be a liberal or conservative. You just have to care about the mission. And that he wanted to work with the career workforce to make things better in government. And that was 6 days after he took office. So he recognized if he wanted to succeed, he needed the federal workforce. If he wanted to make things better, he needed the federal workforce. And he recognized that they had talent, that they had institutional knowledge, that they had the ability to execute on his priorities, and he went and asked for their help, as opposed to going and saying, you know, you're all the deep state and you're evil and you're working against me and I want to terrify you. He didn't do that. And he was probably more effective at getting things done with the federal workforce than the current administration is. And I think that's really important.
Of course, it didn't hurt that he had been head of the CIA.
Yes.
And you talk about having to trust your workforce.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, you want to get things done. And so much of what's being done is almost on a trust basis. And we believe in people that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, because we can't necessarily have that transparency into it. You know,
right.
So I think he probably learned some lessons from that. What
I'm
a great
sure he did.
You know, it's very clear to me, and I don't know if you agree with this, but it's very clear to me that efficiency was not the goal of DOGE. It was about disruption and maybe even disabling, you know, and it just literally preventing aspects of government from functioning, perhaps even hobbling it to the point where it wouldn't resist what some of the elected leadership wanted to do. But we've seen some changes. The I wanted to use the word perpetrator, but the driving force behind it, Elon Musk, is back to the private sector, paying attention to those things there. Other people seem to have moved on. The president seems to have moved on from paying attention to this area. Again, whether you want to call it efficiency or destruction or whatever, what do you think is the near and maybe even the long-term future as a result of what's happened already and these changes that we've seen in the last few weeks? Where are we going?
I think what you're going to see is a little more normalizing of the approach toward how you might restructure government. My understanding is that the director of OMB, Russ Vought, is going to be the person taking over DOGE as, you know, an additional duty for him. Yeah. And, you know, granted, he was the, you know, kind of the architect of Project 2025, which some people viewed as a really great thing, and other people viewed as a not very great thing at all. But I think because he is a part of the institution of the White House as the director of OMB, we'll probably see a little more normal approach to trying to make reductions in agencies. The Musk approach clearly did not work. You know, he promised $2 trillion of savings, and now it's down to like 100 and some odd billion, and with a cost of implementing of more than 100 billion, so probably no savings. A lot of destruction, a lot of terrorizing of federal workers, not much delivering value for the federal, for the American people, no real savings for the American people. So, you know, I think what we're going to find is things will settle down a bit. We also have a lot of court cases that are still pending. You know, a judge recently ruled that the cuts they were doing had to stop, that they were unconstitutional because they were trying to cut things that the Congress had already passed and appropriated money for, and said you can't you know, you have to spend at least X amount of money and they aren't spending it. So we have to see those court cases shake out. And where those court cases land is anybody's guess. The, you know, the some of the cases that have gone against the administration have been decided by judges that President Trump appointed in his first term. So these were his appointees, and they're telling them, no, you can't do this.
Right.
So I think we have to let those shake out. Most of them are going to end up before the Supreme Court, and then we'll have to find out where the Supreme Court lands on them. And I don't think that's, I think anybody who tells you they know how that's going to turn out is smoking something. They don't know. They don't know how they're going to turn out. And, you know, I think that's, so I think what we're going to see is we're going to see the Doge onslaught turn down to something much more normal and rational, and probably still not, you know, big fans of the federal workforce running the program. Sure. But I can't imagine that the director of OMB is going to let some 22-year-old from Twitter, you know, run roughshod over, you know, the secretary of a department that is, you know, a Senate-confirmed presidential appointee and a member of the president's cabinet. So I would expect the cabinet to have much more to say about this and have much more of a say on how cuts are made in their departments and agencies. So that's what I'm expecting. And some of them, I think, are going to, you know, probably start it out, say, okay, yeah, we're all gung-ho with Doge. And as they start hearing from the people that work for them how they're going to get bitten in the backside by some of these cuts, they're going to probably back off on some of the stuff because they know that they're the ones who are accountable for getting things done now, and they're going to want to get things done and not be the ones who are, you know, are blamed for some massive screw up. You know, imagine the Commissioner of Social Security, you know, being the first head of Social Security to not pay checks some month.
Right.
If that happens, he's going to be in a world of hurt. And so I would assume that some of these folks, as they get more control over their departments and agencies, are going to start recognizing that just cutting the workforce right and left isn't serving them at all. And they probably recognize that the president hasn't shown a tremendous amount of loyalty to his appointees. You know, if it starts looking bad for him, then he's certainly going to be willing to fire people.
Sure.
And so I would assume those folks are going to start trying to exert more control over their own organizations. And they'll work with OMB, as departments and agencies always do, on budget issues. But they're going to want to try to exert control over their own domains and recognize that they're accountable for things that get broken and that don't work.
And I think if they're the political animals, they should be, because at that level, they should be highly sensitive to political issues. They're going to learn quickly the difference between fame and infamy. Mm-hmm. As you said, I'd hate to be the Social Security Administrator who was the first one in the 90-year history of Social Security not to deliver checks that month. And that's just one example. It's a, what we can all relate to. But there are examples all throughout government of, do you want to be the one who failed to deliver these services that people expect? And, you know, the midterms are not that far away. People are going to start campaigning here in about 6 months. And we're going to hear this slog through the next year toward the November 2026 elections. And these arguments are going to come to the fray. They're going to come to the forefront. And I really wonder if Congress, who's currently in an undisclosed location in a bunker somewhere, will emerge and start to assert itself, at least individuals who are concerned about their vulnerabilities. So you're right.
Yeah, and some of them on the Hill just this week have started to assert themselves a little bit over the airplane gift from Qatar. So some of them are starting to exert themselves over that. Yeah. I'm hearing some of them exerting themselves, and some you might not expect, exerting themselves a bit over cuts to Medicaid. Mm-hmm. You know, Senator Hawley, very conservative, you know, pro-Trump senator, saying, you know, it's political suicide to go out and cut Medicaid. It's terrible. You shouldn't be taking health care away from people. I have heard some expressions of concern from Susan Collins, but she tends to wring her hands and say she's concerned and then fall in line.
Very concerned.
But, you know, I think that what they're going to find is that some of these cuts, in theory, sound great. You know, and the people who are very positive toward the president, a lot of them have, you know, been very gung-ho for DOGE and all the stuff they're doing. But what happens, you know, and the president and DOGE wanted to go after FEMA. You know, they'd like to get rid of FEMA, totally do away with it, just, you know, push all this stuff back to the states. So who comes in asking, you know, for putting a handout at FEMA? Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, president's former press secretary, and, you know, really strong supporter of the president. She goes in, you know, making the normal type of post-disaster request for funds from FEMA. And FEMA says, no, write the check yourself.
Yeah.
And she, I'm assuming she still is a big proponent of getting rid of FEMA, but maybe not. Maybe they thought it wouldn't affect them.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at FEMA, FEMA is a great example. If you look at FEMA, where does most FEMA money go? Florida?
Yeah.
The South. Texas? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes to hurricane states, a lot of it. I don't know how Florida is going to respond if they have a, you know, couple hundred billion dollar hurricane hit them and they go to FEMA and FEMA says, sorry, there's no money here for you. Go away.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to watch. The other thing that will be interesting is if they do start trying to push a lot of this stuff back, the states that are the net takers from the federal pot are primarily red states.
9 out of 10.
And so are they going to be so, you know, gung-ho about putting stuff back in the states when they find out that, hey, you know, we used to get $5 billion a year more than we paid into the federal government income tax. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of the folks in the South talk about, you know, bailing out the blue states. But, you know, the biggest net contributor to the federal budget, the state that puts more money in than they get out by far, billions and billions of dollars, is New York. If anybody has a right to complain about the federal government taking and not giving back equal value, it's New York. It's not Florida.
Right.
It's not Texas. It's not Mississippi or Alabama. It's New York. It's Connecticut. It's California. You know, there are a lot of states that put a heck of a lot more money into the federal government than they get out, and they tend to be the ones that a lot of people on the right criticize. But, you know, they're happy to take their money and spend it, apparently.
Well, for the longest time, the rhetoric pasted over this stuff.
Uh-huh.
Now we've got an administration that's actually acting on what was just empty rhetoric before, and it's going to expose these fissures.
Yes, left it will.
And I know we started with human capital, and we expanded it to the whole idea of government, but who is the government? It's the people, the people that come in every day, the people that we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes of just, you know, what. You know, these are the people that get this stuff done.
Yes.
And when we've seen a harm to that force, I think it harms everything and everybody across the nation. I'd like to, in the little bit of time we have left, I'd like to kind of turn the tables typically with our guests. And I ask them, you know, what else do you want to make sure our audience hears that we haven't covered already? So I'll hand it over to you, Jeff.
Well, I think the main thing, and I've probably talked about this some already, is the federal workforce, number one, is not a monolith. There are lots of Democrats working for the federal government. There are lots of Republicans working for the federal government. They still do their jobs, whether their party is in power or not. They carry out the missions of those agencies, whether they agree with how the administration in power is doing it, they still carry out their duties. Every one of them raised their right hand and took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. And they do that every day. And if someone asks them, you know, are you responsible for carrying out the Constitution, supporting the Constitution? They don't have to think about whether or not a lawyer told them something. They just say, well, yes, I took an oath of office to do that. And I think that's really important that people in government care about the missions of their agencies. They care about serving the American people. They will give advice. You know, I've given advice to political appointees of both parties when they want to do something that was either illegal or stupid. When they want to do something that's illegal, you explain to them, you know, this isn't legal and here are the reasons why. And every single time I've had that conversation with somebody, they've said, okay, I understand. Is there a legal way to do, to accomplish what I'd like to accomplish? And then you tell them if there's a legal way. You say, okay, yeah, you here's a way to do that would be legal. So it's important to recognize that, you know, you tell people in both parties that. And when you tell somebody that what they want to do is stupid, you don't tell them, hey, you know, what you want to do is stupid. What you do is you say, okay, you know, we've actually tried this, you know, three different times and it failed every time. And so what you're wanting to do is something that we already have a history with frequently, and it's never worked. The good thing is that you clearly are trying to solve a problem that other people wanted to solve too, because we keep trying to find a way to fix this. And so most of them appreciate hearing that, yes, we've identified a problem that needs to be fixed, but this particular solution is one that isn't going to work. And then they will work with you to try to come up with a solution that would work. And that's the way career employees generally work with politicals. You know, when I was doing training for Obama appointees, I would tell these folks, you know, you're not going to get anything done without that career workforce. You have zero ability to execute on your own. So if you want to succeed, you find a way to work with the people who know the mission, who know the rules, who know the history, who've got all the institutional knowledge. They have the interagency relationships. They're the ones who can actually make things happen for you. But the way you do it is by working with them, not by just trying to intimidate them into doing whatever you want. If you try to intimidate people into doing whatever you want, you do run the risk of running into malicious compliance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a boss once who was actually a career employee who wanted to do some really incredibly stupid things. And I explained to him, you know, I think you should consider this and this. Here are some likely outcomes of what you want to do. And he was pretty clear. I'm the boss. You do what I want. So we did exactly what he wanted, every last bit of it. He got fired. Didn't actually get fired. He got run out of the agency and retired. But we complied. You know, he wouldn't listen. He didn't want, nobody was as smart as he was. He was the most brilliant person on the face of the earth. He knew everything. So eventually, after we tried to protect him from himself, we just complied with what he wanted. And he went away. Then I ended up having to negotiate the settlement for him going away. I had to negotiate my boss's departures a couple of times because of people who were doing stupid things and getting themselves in trouble. Most people are willing to do what their bosses want. They would tell them if they're about to do something that will get them in trouble. But now and then, all you can do is comply and let them own the results of what they've ordered.
Sure. But for the most part, people don't purposefully get active or passive aggressive and let their superiors fail.
No,
but you're right. You can antagonize people to the point where they'll say, well, okay, go ahead, step in that.
Yes. You want to drive off the cliff, hit the gas, but I'm going to be bailing out of the passenger door
either way, before
you go off that cliff.
That's right. You know, and I think it's safe to say, and I think I speak for most federal employees everywhere, regardless of how you vote, regardless of what newspapers you read, regardless of what conversations you have over the dinner table, Monday morning at 7:30, you walk in the door and you do what you're responsible for doing 99.9% of the time without even thinking about the politics of it. And I'm looking forward to a time when I used to work in a prison. And it was a brand new prison. This is before my government experience, but after my military experience. And it was nuts. It was a brand new prison. We went from 0 to 400 inmates in 3 weeks. We worked 31 straight days. Finally, I remember looking at the warden and saying, when does this end? And he said, Rich, we're just looking for the dull routine. once we find the dull routine, everybody can go back to normal. And he was right. A week or two later, we're in much more of a dull routine. And that's what you want out of your government, folks. You want reliability. You want repeatable successes. If you press that button, you get that result.
Right.
That's what the federal government and its workforce delivers when it can be in a steady state. It doesn't mean it's not susceptible to improvement and change. It is. However, day in and day out, these people deliver the goods. And to come in and say, well, we're just going to act fast and break things, completely, it's a complete antithesis to what government is supposed to be, which is that reliable machine that delivers and delivers. Every time I put in a dollar, I want a Dr. Pepper to fall into the bin every single time. And that's what government delivers. And I really appreciate the opportunity to dig into this with you, Jeff. I can't believe that you're here.
And I enjoyed it.
So thrilled that you decided to come on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed the discussion.
Oh, man, I just can't believe it. And for the, if we didn't make it clear, that was a long time ago for a little bit of period of time where I worked for somebody who worked for Jeff. So we did have that connection, and I can't believe that he came on the show today. Jeffrey Neal, former Chief Human Capital Officer of the second largest department in the government and a highly experienced professional in the largest department in the government, the Department of Defense. So between the DOD and the DHS, Jeff, I think you really have provided us some very valuable insights into what's going on today as it relates to human capital and the federal government. So thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining us on the Human Capital Lab podcast, a Growth Network podcast production in collaboration with Bellevue University. For more info, visit humancapitallab.org. If you were inspired today, pass the link on to a colleague or friend. Stay tuned for our next episode, and until then, keep learning to unlock the long-term potential of human capital.